Kevin and Abe and a bunch of people from the Primary Purpose Group in Calgary came down for our very first meeting. And since I had moved, I was in the market for a new sponsor, because of course my sponsor was in Calgary, and I just wasn't able to see him anymore, and all these people came down to our very first meeting, and I heard Kevin share, and his passion for bringing the solution, and the big one, and all of that stuff made me realize that I found my new sponsor, and I believe I asked him that very same day. I think it was the same day. And lo and behold, he lives in Calgary, and I don't, but I come here on a regular basis, and we talk off and on quite a bit, so I'm not going to take up any more time. I'm pretty sure you'll catch on to his passion for the program and the solution as it's laid out in the big book. So without any further ado, here's Kevin.
Hey everybody, my name is Kevin. I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. As you can see, I rushed in at the last minute. I apologize for that. I couldn't find parking anywhere. I was praying fervently, driving around in circles downtown, like, God, please stop me from fucking going crazy because I'm gonna fucking kill someone right now. And I knew, like, you know, it might be okay. I'll get to the meeting and maybe they'll have picked another speaker because I was there late, and that would have been awful. I would not have been. No, I'm just kidding. It would have been fine. I want to thank anyone who specifically came here to hear me tonight. Brad came in from out of town, and it's an honor. I was so I'm recording this for a friend of mine, Clint, who's up north, and we were texting back and forth. He's working up north right now, and we were texting back and forth, and he said, I really wanted to hear you. I really think I could identify with your story. You know, that sitting alone in my apartment listening to Alice in Chains with a straight blade kind of shit. I'm like, thank you. That's my story. It's thank you. Thank you very much. It was just funny. He just kind of nailed it. That's kind of what my alcoholism looked like. That's kind of where it was. And it's certainly, my life is certainly not like that anymore. Although I do still really like Alice in Chains. I still think they're a very talented band. Alice in Chains is not responsible for my alcoholism. Right? But what I told Clint, and I hope will transpire tonight, is that I will spend 10 minutes talking about the problem, and I will spend about 50 minutes talking about the power of God. Okay? And talking about, obviously, the solution and the 12 steps and the program of action, all those things. But one of the things that I have learned, and that I needed to learn, is that all the things that I do in AA, going to meetings, yes, the 12 steps, yes, reading the big book, yes, working with newcomers, yes, they're all important. But the end result of all of those things is the solution. See, going to meetings doesn't get me sober. Working the 12 steps doesn't get me sober, necessarily. And you'll see, I know you're probably thinking, like, what's he talking about? Right? The 12 steps don't get me sober. The 12 steps get me connected to the thing that gets me sober. And what gets me sober is the power of God. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. That's what we have to offer. Okay? And I'm not afraid to use that word, God. I am not a religious man by any means. But I will point out that it mentions the word God several times in our 12 steps. That is the foundation of our program. Starts right in step 3. God as we understand him. Several places in the steps it talks about the power of God. So today I don't pull any punches on that. You know, I'm not afraid or ashamed to talk about God. And if you are, and I'm talking about God, and every time I use that word God, you get a little like, you know, the book says bristle with antagonism. And I understood that when I was new. I understood that. I didn't come here with the power of God. Trust me. I didn't come here wanting anything other than to be led out of that apartment listening to Alice in Chains with a straight blade. And it wasn't actually an apartment. It was actually a basement suite. A series of basement suites. I got kicked out of many basement suites, right? Ultimately, all the things that I do in AA, the 12 steps, getting involved in service work, all of those things are all in aid of me having this spiritual awakening, in aid of me getting connected to this God, this power greater than myself, that we believe in Alcoholics Anonymous is the solution to alcoholism. I think our book is pretty clear about that. Now, there's a lot of great, other great things that I can do in my life and other other wonderful treatments and therapies and stuff like that that are fine. They're great. But what I needed to do is to understand that these things were great in addition to a solid foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous, not instead of, right? And that's what ultimately worked for me, and that's what ultimately changed my life. So I will say that I was born in Calgary. I'm an only child. I've got two fantastic parents. To this day, my parents suffer from none of the symptoms of alcoholism whatsoever. My parents are heavy drinkers by the definition of the word, or not heavy drinkers, but moderate drinkers. Okay, they're social drinkers by the definition of the word social drinker. My parents are that, undoubtedly. They can take it or they can leave it alone. They have no problem with alcohol whatsoever. My parents will have a cocktail before dinner, maybe a glass of wine with dinner, and that's it. And this is where I came from. This is my blood. And I do not identify with that type of drinking whatsoever. I was out with my dad a while ago, and we were at a hotel or whatever, and he had a bottle of rye that he had bought in his hotel room, and he was mixing like a rye and Coke. And the way my dad does that is he gets a glass and puts ice in it. He has a shot glass and he pours 1 ounce, and that 1 ounce goes into the glass and he fills the rest with Diet Coke, and he'll sit and drink that drink. And okay, that's cool. And then we went out to a restaurant. We went out to the restaurant. Server comes over and orders drinks, and my dad says, yeah, I'll get just a Diet Coke, please. And I noticed that, right? I noticed that. And I said, Dad, you're not going to have a Ryan Coke here? He said, no, I don't really like the way Ryan Coke tastes in restaurants. You know, they use cheap rye, and the Diet Coke doesn't taste the same. I might have another one when I go back to my room, but no, I'm good with just Diet Coke for right now. And I thought, Dad, am I adopted? Because that is so far from my realm of understanding of what drinking looks like. But that's who I come from. That's who I come from. They were great people. There's certainly nothing, you know, I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home or anything like that. And I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but I will tell you that when I took my first drink, an alcoholic was born. When I was 12 years old, I had an opportunity to get drunk for my first time. And I knew immediately I did not drink like a normal 12-year-old. I stole that joke. I stole that joke from another speaker. It's a great one. Yeah, man. It was great. The first time I ever got drunk was with my best friend Adam and his older brothers. And all his older brother's friends. Remember how it was when you were a kid and you got to hang out with the older kids? You were hanging out and partying with the older kids. And, man, they were 16. They had, like, driver's licenses. And some of them were even older and could, like, get alcohol. So I'm 12 years old, and we're going out to this farm party. Okay? And it was, I'll never, ever forget this. You know, somebody handed me a 2-liter of Rockaberry wine cooler. Okay? Anybody remember those? Remember Rockaberry wine coolers? And that was it. I could drink as much of that as I wanted. And I certainly had no problem with that. And I drank that, and we were driving out to this farm party, and I was in the back of a pickup truck. But I was like laying down in the flatbed of a pickup truck on a beautiful summer night looking up at the stars. Anybody here ever done that before? That's magical, isn't it? You're 12 years old, lit up on this Rockaberry wine cooler for the first time. It was magical. And to date myself a little bit, at that time, there was music coming out of the cab that I'd never heard before. I'd never heard music like that. And a band named Metallica had just released a song called Enter Sandman, right? And it's blasting out of the cab. Man, we were off to Never Never Land, you know? And we got to that party, and I immediately started doing a bunch of things that were going to follow me throughout the rest of my drinking career. I started stealing drinks from people. I started trying to fight people. I started trying to hit on girls. I started trying to, I spilled drinks all over myself. I was just crazy. And I couldn't get enough. As soon as I had that rock, that wine cooler was done, I think I threw it over the side of the pickup truck before we even got to the party. And I just started doing everything I could to get as much alcohol in me. I didn't understand it at the time. I didn't know this. I wouldn't know this for years until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I understand. I had triggered the physical allergy. That's what Dr. Silkworth talks about. Okay? In the chapter, The Doctor's Opinion. I suffered from a physical allergy. Manifests itself in the phenomenon of craving for more alcohol. Once I put alcohol into my body, I have no control over the amount that I'm going to take. Okay? I have an addictive craving for alcohol. The more alcohol I put in my body, the more alcohol I want. Right? It's never satiated. Which explains to me why, when I was at a bar, you know, drinking later in my life, at 2 o'clock when they put the ugly lights on, and it was last call and they're sending everybody home, everybody's like, where are we going? And I'm trying to figure out, how can I get more alcohol? Because everyone else has had their 6 or 7 drinks and they're good. I've had 16 drinks and that allergy is eating me alive at that moment. And I will do anything for more alcohol. Which is why, you know, raise your hand if you ever bought off sales after the bar closed. Yeah, only alcoholics have a need for off sales after the bar closes, right? I would do anything. I was that guy at 5 a.m. walking around the party while everybody else is passed out, trying to get people to stay up and drink with me, walking around drinking people's bottom beers, right? And tipping one back, and what would happen eventually? These are my people. I'm in the right room. If you've never tipped a beer bottle back and gotten a cigarette in the mouth, I don't know what to tell you. That's good living right there. Anyway, so I was at that party and 12 years old and whatever, and I woke up the next morning and I want you guys to know I suffered no consequences from that whatsoever, zero consequences. And I had found what I felt at that time was my solution to life, okay? Now, the other thing that we talk about in AA is the spiritual sickness, the spiritual malady. Now, I didn't know at 12 years old that I was suffering from a spiritual malady. It's not like I was walking around on the playground one day and they said, Kevin, how are you feeling? I said, well, I'm feeling a little spiritually sick today. Mm. I didn't know that's what it was, but I knew that whatever it was, you know, it's like I didn't even know how bad I was feeling until I knew how good I could feel. My buddy Danny talks about the first time I drank, I experienced feelings that I did not know were available to me. I felt a joy and a peace and a freedom and all the stuff that it talks about we aspire to in AA. But I had just found it through Rockaberry wine cooler and a bunch of stolen beers and some vodka and some paralyzer. And, you know, and I made a decision right then and there that I was going to drink as much as I possibly could, as often as I could. Why wouldn't I? Because I suffered zero consequences from that. There was no downside. It was all plus. Okay? I was like, my life now is just better with alcohol in it. I will be a better human being. I will be more effective and all that stuff, drinking. And I made a decision at 12 years old that I was going to start drinking as much as possible. And I was, I told you my parents are normal drinkers, but they had, you know, an extensive liquor cabinet. And I was able to, for years, I mean, that's how it was. I told you guys I was an only child, so I had no siblings to worry about. I could totally dodge and lie to my parents and all that shit, and I could steal as much alcohol as I wanted. I had older friends that would bootleg for me, and by the time I was 14 years old, I was drinking daily. I had a routine every morning. I would I'd go to the liquor cabinet. I'd steal as much alcohol as I could. I would drink vodka and amaretto and Drambuie and, you know, and then trying to manage the levels of all the bottles so that it wouldn't be too noticeable, right? And I'm drinking Glenfiddich Scotch and all that stuff. And then around that same time, I discovered drugs. I discovered all different types of drugs. And one of the things I would do was go to my parents' medicine cabinet then and find whatever pills said do not take with alcohol, may cause drowsiness. And I would take 10 of them. And wash it down with vodka, and go to school. That's, by the time I was 14, that's what my life looked like. And by the time I was 16, I was using drugs much more extensively. I want you to know, I know that we have a singleness of purpose here, but I want you to know definitively that I used drugs alcoholically. So I'll talk about it here. That's a joke, guys, come on. That was it. And I, at that time, I was fully functional. I was able to, I was highly functional. I had, when I graduated high school, I was, I was second or third runner up to being valedictorian of my high school class. I was student president of my high school class. I was in the school play. We did Grease that year, and I was Danny Zuko, for anybody who knows Grease, if you can believe that. I had a lot more hair then. I was a peer supporter. So I was like a peer counselor, right? Which was funny. Because people would come to me oftentimes and sit in like a little peer counseling room. We talk to them all about their drinking and their drug problems, and I get them connected to ADAC and all that shit. And I was drunk most of the time. I was, you know, under the influence of people that I was counseling and doing all that stuff. I had a job at Zellers at the time, in the warehouse or whatever. And I had a relationship. I had a girlfriend and all that stuff. On the outside, everything looked good. I was able to maintain my life. And a lot of us get here, you know, with some experience of what that looks like. I was able to maintain things on the outside. Inside, every day, every night of my life, I was down in the basement listening to Alice in Chains with a straight blade. Okay, that's what it was. Down in at that time, it was my parents' basement. For most of us, what happens is we cross over a line from functional alcoholism into complete chaos. And for me, that happened. Three things happened kind of simultaneously that really took a toll on me, and I was not in control anymore. And what happened to me is I graduated high school, and I went away to university for the first time. So for the first time, I was no longer under the guidance or restriction of my parents. The second thing is that relationship that I had been in ended, and I had a broken heart. Aww, everybody, right? No. And the third thing is that I turned 18. So all of that stuff that I just talked about happened before I was even legally old enough to drink. When I turned 18, and it was like a complete revolutionary thought in my mind that I was now able to go into any bar or any liquor store whenever I wanted and buy as much alcohol and booze as I could possibly get whenever I wanted. I want you to know my life changed. Okay, and not for the better. And things got very sick very quickly. I was living in Lethbridge at the time. I was living in residence, which are underground and affectionately known as the dungeons at the University of Lethbridge. And it was. I remember being as physically sick as I've ever been in my life sitting in those residences. I started to experience hangovers that were so bad, and I started to go through all the things that alcoholics go through. Not usually at age 18, but I started to get the shakes in the morning. I started to go through mild forms of delirium tremens. I started to hallucinate when I was drunk, and I started to hallucinate when I was coming down. I remember a couple of very, 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 very nightmare episodes of that kind of thing. I started to get wine sores. I don't know if you know what wine sores are, but you start to get like scabs because the alcohol is trying to come out and it can't come out. It can't be processed any other way. So it starts to come out your skin. And that's shit started happening to me like early on. It means my body was shutting down. Anyway, so I got a call from a friend in Medicine Hat. Now, I'd been a guitar player for a long time, and I'd known these guys, and I was a musician, and they had just signed a record deal, and their bass player just quit. And the call I got on the phone, I'm sitting in the dungeons at the University of Lethbridge, and I don't know how I'm going to get through this semester. And my parents are still, like, paying for this semester, okay? Like, my parents have no idea any of this shit is going on. And so he calls and says, would you like to quit university and come join our punk rock band and go on tour across Canada with us, fully paid for by the record company? And I said, yeah, sure. Yeah, that would be okay. So that's what I did. It was no big deal. That level of Music, I equate it to, you know, if NHL is like real stardom, I was playing like double A, okay, double A music, you know what I mean? And that was it. We went on tour for a long time, and I discovered an alcoholic's three favorite words, free liquor tab. Band drinks for free, man. And it got real nasty, and real sick and real fucked up. I mean, that's all I can really remember. I don't want to belabor it. I think I'm talking too long about my what happened anyway. All I'll say is I got kicked out of that band, and I didn't get kicked out of that band for drinking, and I didn't get kicked out of that band for not being a talented musician. I didn't get kicked out of that band because they didn't like me. I got kicked out of that band because I belligerently refused over and over and over to stop drinking and driving. I belligerently refused. They said, Kevin, we need you to either get sober or not drive. We don't care what you do, just stop driving because you're in kind of the public spotlight and you're going to run over a kid or you're going to get in a car accident and you're going to be drunk, and we don't want that kind of exposure in our band. And I would say, yeah, guys, no, never again, never again. And some, I don't know what's wrong with me. I think I suffer from another form of the allergy, that the more I drink, the more I want to drive. You know, I'm just a fucking asshole. I am just a selfish, self-centered dick. And it got really, like, Degrassi junior high style. Like, people would try to have these big interventions about me drinking and driving and try to take my keys, or there'd be times where people would take my shoes away so that I wouldn't drink and drive. And I can remember many times driving home in the winter in sock feet, because fuck you, I'm driving my car tonight. And the more I drank, and so eventually that band just said, you're done, and we're parting ways. And I don't know, a lot of it, truthfully, a lot of it is a blur. I tried to go to university and college and do some of that shit. You know, the truth is, I went to my first NA meeting when I was 17. And around the time that I got kicked out of that band and left university, or couldn't, I got kicked out of college or whatever. I don't even really remember what happened. I just know that I went to my first AA meeting when I was 18 in Medicine Hat, and then I was not welcome at my parents' house anymore, and I was going to try to get into this treatment center, and so I went to Regina. Around that time, I knew I had a problem. Okay? Like it was evident, and I knew I was getting sick, and I knew I was going to probably die, either by suicide or a car accident, or something was going to happen. And I knew it was bad, and I knew that I was hurting everyone in my life, and I knew all that shit. And so I started to go to treatment centers, and I did that for a long time. It doesn't mean I started to accept this solution whatsoever. It doesn't mean I started to accept Alcoholics Anonymous or the power of God at all. It just means that I went to a lot of treatment centers, okay? And that's what it was. I would go to a treatment center for a little while, just long enough to get the heat off. You know, I love the line. I say it all the time. You got just healthy enough to have a good long relapse. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I would go to treatment centers for. Get some exercise, and, you know, I'd get, you know, some good food, and you know, there's a lot of treatment centers around that are not AA based, and you get to do all kinds of, like, volleyball therapy and video game therapy and all. I remember this one treatment center I went to that they had a feelings board, and every morning we'd have to get up and go in front of the group, and there'd be a big feelings board with, like, all the different feelings that you could have, and you'd have your little thing, and you'd go up and put the feeling on, and then what was even cooler is you got to hold everybody hostage for a while you explain to them why you were feeling that way, right? You know, fucking, what a bunch of fucking bullshit. And that shit, I thought that was, you know, I don't know, man. What I want to talk about really now is that's what started to happen. And I started to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was around Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was. None. And I do not think, man, I don't know. Sometimes I wonder, like, was it just that I couldn't hear it because I was not ready? Or is it that we don't actually do a very good job in Alcoholics Anonymous of explaining to newcomers what Alcoholics Anonymous really is? Really. And we let people kind of figure it out for themselves, kind of, or die. Because I want you guys to know, man, I, like, there was a period in my life when I was, like, 21, 22 years old. So, like I say, I went to my first meeting when I was 17. I had my last drink when I was 22. And between that time and that 5 years, I relapsed 7 times. And that was probably the hardest, most difficult, lowest, probably highest risk of suicide time in my life. Do you guys know that more alcoholics commit suicide sober than they do when they're drunk? Because an alcoholic of my type, you take alcohol away, alcohol is not my problem. Alcoholism is my problem, okay? You take alcohol away from me, alcohol is my solution to my living problem. The problem is when I'm sober, I can't stand the way that I feel. I can't stand it because of that spiritual sickness. And the spiritual sickness gets so bad that I gotta pick up a drink. And I pick up that drink and it kicks in that physical allergy. And the physical allergy takes off and the drinking becomes so bad and my life gets so fucked up that I gotta get sober again. And I get sober and I swear off. That's it, I'm done. I'm never gonna drink like that again. I promise this time I mean it. I went to treatment and I did the volleyball therapy and everything's gonna be fine. And without any type of spiritual solution, eventually, 9 days later, 19 days later, 9 months later, the fucking spiritual sickness gets so bad and so painful and so fucked up and I'm so crazy and angry and frustrated and restless and irritable and discontent and all the stuff that it talks about, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, the four horsemen of alcoholism that it talks about in the chapter of Vision for You, it gets so bad that I got to drink again. I have to drink in order to preserve my sanity. And this cycle is repeated over and over. And unless the alcoholic has a complete psychic change, there is very little chance of his recovery. And that's really it. So I want you guys to know, I was around AA, man. I wanted it. I really did. But I sometimes wonder if we don't do a very good job of really grabbing newcomers and sitting them down and explaining to them exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous is. Because it isn't 90 meetings in 90 days or we'll restore your misery. That is not Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say that without reservation. Alcoholics Anonymous is those 12 steps up there. 12 spiritual actions that I can take towards creating what it talks about in step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I take the 12 steps. I have that spiritual awakening. And the next thing I do, I got to go take it to other people. I got to go carry that message to other people. Right? And these are the things that we do that create this relationship with God today that we have. There was a time in my life when I was in Alcoholics Anonymous where I was going to 5 AA meetings a day. Right? I was going to the 7 a.m. at Parkdale. I don't know if that's still there. I would go to the... Then there was a 9:30 at Parkdale. I don't know if that's still there. Then I would go to the Nooner at Glenmore. I'm pretty sure that's still there. I would go to the 1:30 at Garnet, and I'm pretty sure that's still there. I would go home and sleep for a couple hours. I would get up and I would go to the 8:30 at Glenmore, and I'm pretty sure that's still there. And I would go home and I would stay awake all night. Fucking insane. Fucking crazy. Restless, irritable, and discontent in ways that I can't explain. That people, probably only people in this room understand. Living through depression and anxiety and fear and anger all night long until I could just barely get on a bus. I'm doing that on the bus, by the way. All those 5 meetings all day long on the bus. That's what I was doing. I was not employed. I was unemployable. Going to these 5 meetings a day thinking, this is AA. And I would go into AA meetings and I'd put on my AA face. And people would say, how you doing, Kev? Oh, fantastic. So happy to be sober, I can barely stand it. And I would leave that meeting and I would go home and I'd take off my AA face. And what would happen? I'd want to fucking kill myself again. Thinking, this is sobriety. Is this recovery? Is this what the old timers mean when they talk about it keeps getting better? because this is not getting better. And I guess what happened is, you know, ultimately I surrendered again after another relapse where I had ended up homeless and I called a treatment center again, a place called 1835 House, and I had already been there, so I called there a second time to see if I could get back into 1835 House. And I went in, and I remember calling my sponsor, a guy named David, and I said, "David, you know, I drank again, and I can't figure out. I don't know why. Like I told myself I was going out with these guys, and I told myself I knew that they were drinking, but I told myself I wasn't going to drink that night. I am not going to drink tonight. Okay, that's it. I've been around AA. I got like 4 months sober right now. I had a job. I'm doing okay. I'm going out with these guys. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink tonight." And I went out and I drank. And I was gone for 4 days. And spent all my rent money. Blew everything. You know, it happened again. And this is like, I've been around AA multiple times. Going to those 5 meetings a day. I'd been in and out of multiple treatment centers. I'd lived in psych wards and hospitals. You know, I've been like, and yet I drank again. And that's what, you know, we talk about the insanity of alcoholism, okay? The insanity of alcoholism is not the crazy fucked up shit that I do when I drink. The insanity of alcoholism is that after all of that, even though I had sworn off and said, I'm never going to drink again, the insanity of alcoholism, or what we call the mental obsession, is that at some point, without spiritual help, I am going to have a thought at some moment, suddenly. That's what the book says. Suddenly, the thought will come. My real problem as an alcoholic is not alcohol. My real problem is that spiritual sickness that fuels this thought. That there is, that I don't have to feel this sick. That there is a solution in that bottle. And I'm just going to take a little bit of it, and I'm going to feel okay, and it's going to be fine. And that's what I did. Again, after all those times in AA, after all those promises I had made, after all those treatment centers, I said, I'm not going to drink tonight. I'm not going to drink. And I went out and I drank. 4 days later, destroyed everything, on the phone, sobbing with my sponsor again, saying, David, I said I wasn't going to drink and I drank. And I don't understand what's going on. I don't know why. And he said, David and I are so close. I just did another, like of my own fifth step. I just did another one. I did it with David. You know who I'm talking about. David M. And I said, I don't understand. And he said, Kevin, after all this time, you just don't get it. You just don't get it. People like you and I don't have the power to say, I'm not going to drink and have that mean anything. Our defense has to come from a higher power. Our defense has to come from God, Kevin. You and I don't have the power to say, I'm not going to drink and have that mean anything. And I think for the first time, I heard that. I got it. I understood. I just remember that being like one piece, one very important piece of information that I needed to get. So I go to 1835 House, and I was fucking insane. Again, fucking insane. If they would have held a vote about who was going to relapse as soon as they hit the street out of 1835, they would have raised their hands unanimously that Kevin was going to relapse. Like, I was out of my mind. Crazy. I had the social graces of an adult. I had the skills of an adult. I looked like an adult at the intermittent beck and call of a 4-year-old's emotions. That's what I, you know, I guess a 12-year-old, you say once you start drinking is when you stop growing emotionally. I was just an absolute child. I would take 2 steps and laugh, and I would take 2 steps and cry. Just fucking insane. They said, Kim, what do you want to get out of your recovery this time? Now, I'd already been there, right? I lived there at another time for 6 months. 6 months I lived there. I was loaded 2 weeks later. Okay? And it's not that I hadn't been around the deal. I just had never actually taken all 12 of those steps. It's a funny thing. It's the only thing I never really tried in AA. I'd done every other fucking thing there was to do in AA except do the 12 steps and have a spiritual experience of God. I'd never done that. I've never tried it. So anyway, I'm in the house. I'm in 1835 and said, what do you want to get out of your recovery? I said, I want to be able to feel the same emotion for longer than 5 minutes. Right? That's it. Because I was like, I was an absolute emotional roller coaster. By the way, I remember this. When I moved back into the house, the counselor said, Kevin, we want you to know the counselors got together and we voted to let you back into 1835. I said, okay. And they said, we want you to know the vote among the counselors was not unanimous. Because I was crazy. I was a crazy, and I guess they just looked at, like, you know, how willing is this guy? How willing is this guy going to be? My problem was, is that I was smart. That's a problem. That is a grave detriment to you. If you are here and you are new and you are smart, you're going to have a tough time. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry for you. Because I suffered from intelligence for a long time in AA. A long time. People used to say to me, Kevin, you know, you need to get stupid. And I think, why don't you fucking get stupid? Fuck you. You know? And I understand. Now, when people say, you know, no one was ever too dumb to understand the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's a lot of people who want to think their way right through it. There's a lot of people who are too smart to ever get sober. And that's exactly right. And they're exactly right. I tried to think my way. I tried to intellectualize my way through AA. I felt like if I just studied that, the stuff enough, and really like read through the books and learned what to say and learned how to present properly in AA, that when the final exam came, I would ace the exam. Well, there's no exam. There's a pass-fail question at some point when suddenly you get a thought that says, hey, tonight, let's just go out and have six beers, no problem. That's a pass-fail exam, and I continued to fail that exam over and over and over. So what really happened ultimately is that I started to get connected to Alcoholics Anonymous a little bit more. And guys like David were instrumental. But what really ultimately, fundamentally changed my life forever was a big book study with a guy named Cowboy Ray. See, Cowboy Ray, does anybody here remember Cowboy Ray? Anybody here know Cowboy Ray? Nobody knows Cowboy Ray? Yeah. That's really sad. I can't believe that. You used to ask that question, every hand in the room would go up. Isn't that crazy? Cowboy Ray was a guy who started doing big book studies in the city of Calgary before anybody knew what a big book study was. Because Cowboy Ray had met a couple other fellas who changed my life. A couple guys named Joe and Charlie. Anybody here know who Joe and Charlie are? Okay, well, there's a few more hands. That's crazy. Those guys fundamentally changed my life because they taught me this book. They taught me that this book is Alcoholics Anonymous. The program contained within this book is perfection. This is the perfect program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I can do as a member of AA is aspire towards the program dictated in this book. This book is a guide to help take me through those 12 steps. I go through those 12 steps. I have a spiritual experience of God. And then immediately I got to go start working with newcomers. I got to find someone to be of service to. So that's what happened, is I started to attend this Cowboy Ray big book study, and I did multiple studies with Cowboy Ray, and I started studying the book Alcoholics Anonymous extensively. And then one of the most powerful things that ever happened to me in my recovery, you want to know what changed my recovery more than anything else? You know what was the part that I was completely missing for years? That whole time that I was going around AA five meetings a day, what was I doing? I was taking. You know what changed my life in Alcoholics Anonymous? Was the second that I had an opportunity to start giving back to AA. See, that's where change comes from. Change comes when I stop being a fucking user. of people, places, and things, including Alcoholics Anonymous. Every time I came to AA, I came here to take something from you, to get something from you. And when I could change and start to see, hey, you know, I've been around a little bit, now I've had this experience, now get to fucking work. Because I have a debt to pay to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe it. It's not optional. I owe it to Alcoholics Anonymous. Every day, for the life that I have. Everything that I have was given to me by the power of God and nothing else. Everything. And I owe it back. See, the book says that we have a new employer. Being all powerful, he will provide what we need if I stay close to him and perform his work well. What's his work for me to do? Get fucking busy in AA. Period. And I remember the first time I got a sponsee, I'd been probably, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years sober. Sponsorship changed my life. Sponsorship absolutely changed my life, and it gave me a purpose. Bill knows what I'm talking about. Same thing, I've seen it happening to you. When you get switched on with a sponsee like that, you start to get a purpose for living. But you can't transmit something you don't have. So I needed to get this thing, and I need to continue to have this thing. If I don't have this thing, how can I continue to try and teach it and give it away to other people? And it is incredible what happens. It is incredible what's happened in my life, what I've seen happen to people. What I've seen happen to people right now in this room that I'm looking at. I've watched them come in. I've seen their sickness and I've seen their sadness. Okay? And I have seen what is capable with them, not from going to 90 meetings in 90 days, it will restore your misery. I want you to know that meeting makers do not make it. Okay? You know that saying, fake it till you make it? Please, if you are here and you are faking it and you are lying to us about how you're doing in AA, please come and talk to us. Because I want you to know that you don't have to fake it. You don't have to lie about how you're doing. You can come here and just be as fucked up as you need to be. Because I have a way out for you. It's not my way out. It's a way out that I've taken, and it's a way that we can show you. We can teach you. There is absolutely, definitively, a way out. There is absolutely a solution to the problem of alcoholism. They discovered it in 1934. They wrote a book about it in 1939. It works 100% of the time to anyone who's willing to do it. I know they say that percentages in Alcoholics Anonymous are down. Like, oh, only 4 or 5% of people who go to AA really do. That is, do not believe that. I want you to know, and I believe, that the power of God works 100% of the time. Absolutely without fail. If I'm willing to truly surrender, I'm really willing to come into AA and do anything without reservation. And it's not all easy. Man, you know what was a good reminder for me? I just did my own fourth step and fifth step again. And, you know, I've done multiple ones, but I just did it again. You know what was a good reminder for me? It's fucking hard. It's hard to find the willingness and to find the discipline. And it was a good reminder for me at a compassion level. I was just talking about this last night. At a compassion level, to remind myself, when I get short with my sponsees about them not doing it or whatever, that it's not easy. There's a line in the 12 and 12 that I love. Rebellion dogs are step. Dogs are every step, right? Because it's not easy to do this stuff, but if I'm willing really, truly, just to surrender, just to completely give up and do this work. You know, and the thing about surrender, I'll tell you guys a story because this blows me away. And this is what my life is like today. This is the fourth dimension of existence that I live in today. And that's, I know that sounds like some Scientology shit, that fourth dimension stuff, but I'm just quoting the big book because that's what Bill called it. Rocketed into the fourth dimension. And I won't say that I live there all the time, but I'll tell you, like, I spend a good amount of time there. It's fucking, and it's a good place to be. So today, I wanted to get my head shaved. And there's a little barber spot in my building, and I'd never been there. I'd always walked past it, never really went in there. I always go to, like, you know, upscale, stylist. Right? I'm like, I don't really need a fucking stylist. I don't need Vidal Sassoon to figure this shit out. Okay? So I'm going to go just to this little barbershop. I go to this barbershop, and I sit down with a guy, and we start talking. And he said, you know, I said, how's business? He said, it's very good, thank God. And I knew right away, that was code. That was cool. He said that. And I said, God, you believe? And we started to talk. Well, he's Islamic. We started to talk all about all of it. Him and I alone in his barbershop, talking about the power of God, talking about surrender. Because I've talked, anybody who comes to my big book study knows, I talk about this all the time. We need to learn to surrender in AA. The word Islam, translated into English, is translated as the word surrender. They named their whole religion surrender. Okay? And that's what this guy, he tells me this, like he's teaching me this. I'm like, no, I already know that. That's really fucking cool, man. And he told me all this stuff about Muslim and Muhammad and the Quran, and we're talking about God, and we're talking about what God has done in his life, and what God has done in my life. I just went in to get my fucking head shaved. Okay? And when I'm not connected, and he would have said something like that and I never would have heard it. And I would have been sitting there thinking about myself, talking about myself, or just like, I don't want to talk to you, or whatever. Instead, I had this beautiful spiritual experience. He invited me now to come to his church on Friday, which they go to Central United Church, like right downtown. I didn't know that. I like 1:15 every Friday to go if I want to go pray with him. And I might. I don't know. Why not? Why not go check it out? My point is that what I needed to learn to do was surrender completely. Okay, that's the word in AA. And it's not about surrendering to booze and drugs. That's what I thought the problem was for a long time, right? I heard the speaker, oh, you know what the funny thing is about this guy? His name is Muhammad Ali. I asked him what his name was. Now, that, what's funny about that is that there's an analogy that was given to me by a CA speaker one time. He said, for me to think I'm going to get in the ring and fight booze and drugs is like me thinking I'm going to get in the ring and beat Muhammad Ali in his prime. No matter what I learn, no matter what I think I'm going to do, booze and drugs are going to kick my fucking ass every time. Surrender is about getting out of the ring. Get out of the ring and go a different way. So me sitting there in this barbershop, I mean, this happened at like 7 p.m. I'm talking about, okay, tonight. I'm sitting there with Muhammad Ali talking about surrender in the program of Islam and the program of AA. This is my life now. And I want you to know it's a beautiful thing. By way of, you know, what it's like today, I want you to know that I've never been more loved or more surrounded by friends ever in my life. I feel more useful and more purposeful in the things that I do. I teach a big book study on Monday nights. That is the love of my life. We started a group a while ago. Years ago, called Primary Purpose Group, that we are sponsoring this month, and we're grateful for that. We are big-hearted, tough-loving, big-book-thumping, fundamental, power of God is the solution, Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And that's what we wanted to start. There was a series of events that came together, and four of us came together. And the first time we ever met as a group, there was four of us and three guys from the Center of Hope. Who were living in the Center of Hope, and we had a little meeting right in the basement of the church that we're in now, and anyone who's been to PPG knows that we've grown substantially from there. I have dozens of sponsees. The people ask me how many sponsees you have. I don't know. I don't know. Because I have a lot, like Brad, who introduced me, they're just doing well. They still call me their sponsor, and they still check in with me once in a while and let me know how they're doing and all that stuff, but they're doing well. And then I have other guys who are like daily, need daily help. And they are like, they need a lot of help, a lot of high maintenance. And I have seen miracles occur with my sponsees. I remember one of my sponsees was connected after being estranged from his children for 10 years. He was able to sit down with a social worker and they brought his kids in. And he was able to visit with his children for the first time. And he could have anyone in the world he wanted to be there with him when he met his kids again for the first time after 10 years. And he wanted me there. And I got to sit there while he met his kids again. That's a fucking miracle to be a part of that. I've had other sponsees die. It doesn't mean that the power of God is not alive and well. It doesn't mean that the power of God isn't here. It just means that some of us are not ready to surrender. And if you're here tonight, you don't know what I mean when I'm talking about this surrender thing. I challenge you to go home tonight, get down on your knees, and pray to God to help him show you how to surrender. That's one of the things that I was taught. If I don't have faith in God, I can get down on my knees and pray for faith. If I don't know what this surrender is about, I can go home and say, God, please help me to surrender. Help me to completely surrender to you and your power. Please help me to surrender to this program, to this work on a daily basis. The paradox is, if you haven't already surrendered, you're going to hear that and you're going to think, that guy's fucked. I'm never going to try that. Right? That's the paradox. If you're not ready to try praying for surrender, you probably haven't surrendered. So anyway, it's 8:57. I'm all done. Thank you very much for allowing me to share. I love you all. Thank you.